Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Well, if it seems like you've lost control of your home, your family, and even your sanity, then chances are you're either abusing some type of substance or you are living with a depressed teenager. Living with a child who is angry, withdrawn, self-loathing, and failing school is a confusing and draining task that puts a strain on the entire family system. Whether you have young children or are the parents of a teenage child, you want to stay tuned for today's discussion about adolescent depression. Joining us today to discuss adolescent depression is psychiatrist Dr. Francis Mondemore. Dr. Mondemore is the author of 5 books, including one we will touch on today, The Parent's Guide to Adolescent Depression. Dr. Mondemore is currently the director of the Mood Disorders Clinic at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mondemore. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
All right, before we get going on our discussion, I want to let folks know how we can be reached. Questions or comments about adolescent depression, what you can do as a parent, please feel free to call and pick Dr. Mondemore's brain. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Or reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. All right. I guess let's get right to it, Dr. Mondemore. Can you fill us in quickly on what you're doing at Johns Hopkins and why you're focusing on mood disorders in particular?
Well, I'm the director of a specialty outpatient clinic here at Hopkins in the Department of Psychiatry. We're in a large practice. We see about 1,500 patients in a year. And we recognized a number of years ago that we needed a specialty clinic for mood disorders, for depression and bipolar disorder. Johns Hopkins became one of the members of the National Network of Depression Centers, which is a consortium of academic medical centers doing research and a lot of patient care in folks with mood disorders. And in order to do that, we needed to basically establish a clinic, a specialty clinic. And so that's what I've done. We've been at it for about 3 years now. And doing some interesting research, taking what I think is very good care of patients, hopefully doing good work. And so I'm here to spread the word about getting help for these problems.
That's great. So you said Johns Hopkins is it's a large clinic, and do you guys work? I read on the website that you guys work as a team approach. You have therapists and psychiatrists and all sorts of folks working sort of as a group to help folks out. Is that accurate?
Right. Yes. We are very strong believers in a collaborative model for mental health care. And we recognize that being a psychotherapist requires a lot of training. Being a good one requires a lot of talent, a lot of experience, and that also being a psychiatrist, you know, on the medical side of things, dealing with medications, diagnosis, that has become a lot more complicated than it used to be 20, 30 years ago. Back then, there were a few medications in psychiatry, but really you could almost count them on one hand. And it wasn't hard for one person to be an expert in both psychopharmacology, the use of medications to treat psychiatric problems, and psychotherapy. But these days, it's really a very, very rare person who can do both. But we do understand that people with mental health problems usually do the best when they have both a medical approach and a psychological approach, psychopharmacology and psychotherapy together. So all of our patients get some of both. And because we have our own team of therapists that ensures that there's close collaboration, close communication, and good teamwork to do the work we do.
All right, we're going to get into treatment a little bit later on in the hour, and so we can talk a little bit more in detail about different combinations of therapy and counseling and when to use those things. So we'll definitely get to that. But before we get going on that, I do want to ask about the book that you wrote before and recently updated, The Parent's Guide to Adolescent Depression, that you wrote with Dr. Kelly. Now, why did you guys decide to write this? What was sort of the motivation for that?
Well, the second edition, Dr. Kelly joined me on the second edition. The first edition I wrote by myself a few years earlier, and it was interesting. A friend of mine was a librarian in the public library in the city where I was living at the time, and I had written a book on bipolar disorder, which was fairly successful, and she caught me one day and said, you know, you need to write a book on adolescent depression because I have parents coming in here all the time asking for some reading material, and I'm not quite sure what to recommend for them. So that was sort of the impetus. And so then the first edition came out, and Dr. Kelly trained. He was more or less a student of mine at Hopkins. And he went on to get specialty training in child psychiatry. And so when it came time to do the second edition, I thought he would have a lot to add, and he certainly did. So it was basically demand that prompted the writing of the book.
And I guess a lot of changes since, particularly in medicine, since the first publication of the book. So there was a lot to update and worth reading about the medications.
Right. Well, there are always new medications coming along. It's been remarkable in psychiatry that so many, not only new medicines, but new categories of medicines have been introduced in the last 10 years or so. A lot of research has really elucidated some of the connections and cleared up some of the mysteries, especially in pediatric mood disorders. There was always a lot of controversy about the overlap between things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and mood disorders, and that has become somewhat clearer. We had more experience in treating mood disorders in pediatric patients because we simply have more experience now. More research is being done on adolescents and children. A number of years ago, almost any antidepressant that was prescribed for a person under the age of 18 was really a off-label prescription. That very few of the psychiatric medications that were available were FDA approved for use in children and adolescents. And that is something that the FDA really wanted to address very directly. And so now there's a lot more research going on. So we have a lot more good clinical research to back up our practices in psychopharmacology.
Yeah, it seemed like for a long time psychiatrists were just sort of saying, well, this ought to work for kids, and got to try something because kids are out of control. But there weren't any real studies or tests on children. Huh?
Right, right. Psychopharmacology in the pediatric age range was essentially an extension of the adult practices. And we actually have come to understand that, in fact, the physiology is very different in young people, and that actually the classes of medicines that work well in adults often do not work well in teenagers.
Yeah, that's one of the big dilemmas I've run into with families and parents, and they're really worried about their medications. And we're going to get definitely into some of the med stuff a little bit further on, but I want to let's define, you know, I mean, you got a teenager at home. Anybody who's lived with teenagers knows that moodiness and ups and downs and, you know, just like it's sort of, there's a lot of normal, quote unquote, teen moodiness that goes along with being an adolescent and all the upheaval. So what's the difference between normal teen moodiness and, as you talk about in the book, the syndrome of depression in teenagers?
Yeah. You know, this idea that all teenagers are unpredictable and difficult is a little overrated. And studies have actually been done on the moodiness and the kinds of things you're talking about in teenagers. And generally, those kinds of issues do not cause tension within the family most of the time. So, I mean, I like to say that if a parent thinks something's wrong, then the likelihood is that something is wrong. Teenagers with serious depression, they usually have a very significant change in their behaviors and functioning from the baseline. Their grades in school go down. They begin engaging in behaviors that maybe are unusual for them, such as starting to use substances, not paying attention to their schoolwork, withdrawing from social events. So there's usually a real change in functioning that is very definitely a signal, almost leaving out the demeanor of the teenager. So that's always a real indicator, more than a red flag. I mean, a danger sign almost when there's this sudden change in behavior and in level of functioning and success in academic and social settings. We do know that in adolescents, depression often is expressed with irritability, anger, a lot of very negative feelings. It is not always the sadness that you see in adults. And that can be very deceiving. So that although the most obvious and maybe the most upsetting problem is irritable behavior and oppositional behavior, when you do a good examination of the patient, what you discover is that they've got the symptoms of depression. They have low mood, sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, concentration problems, energy level problems, inability to enjoy things that they usually enjoy. And, you know, I've just basically laid out the diagnostic criteria for what we call major depression.
Parents want to know, why is my teenager depressed? And I mean, what's the answer to that? What causes this? You got a kid who's 12 years old, happy-go-lucky, playing sports, engaged with his parents, and then at 13 or 14, he's withdrawn from all his athletic activities. He's isolating in his room, on social media all the time. What causes that?
Well, one of the hallmarks of serious depression is that people lose interest in their usual activities. They don't enjoy what they had enjoyed before. They're filled with negative feelings about themselves, negative feelings about the world, about their future. And so they react to that. They lose interest in social activities. They have concentration problems that makes it difficult for them to learn in school. It's basically the symptoms that drive the behavior. And we believe that in, you know, these serious depressions, that there are a lot of biological factors that are operating. Who gets serious depression is determined by a combination of genetics, which is essentially chemistry, biology, and environment. And the data are pretty convincing that early onset serious depression is a lot more biologically driven than when there's an onset later in life.
And what, when you say early onset, what's the age range? What's considered early?
Prepubertal, usually.
Okay, so 9, 10, 8, 9, 10.
Correct. You know, we used to think that little kids couldn't get serious depression, and this was based on really psychological theories about the maturity and insight of children at that age. As there's been more recognition that these serious depressions in young people are not really quite so much psychologically based, but are more rooted in biology and genetics, we understand that, in fact, depression is something that can strike at any age, childhood, young adulthood, middle age, first onset in the elderly is not uncommon. The peak years for developing a serious episode of a mood disorder are late adolescence, young adulthood. That is the age of onset for these disorders.
Okay, for those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is mood disorder expert Dr. Francis Mondemore from Johns Hopkins Medical Center. Our topic today is adolescent depression. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local number, which is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. You can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so we're talking about the symptoms and the signs of adolescent depression, and you said early onset, so more biologically based for younger kids getting depressed. What about those kids that seem to be rolling along okay until they're 14, 15, 16, and then parents really start noticing a quick shift in grades and who they're hanging out with and just getting isolated and angry and kind of disappearing from the family? When should parents get worried about that? And what's generally the cause of a later kind of onset depression?
Well, the causes appear to be pretty much the same across the way I like to explain it is that, you know, depression, mood disorders are like a lot of other common illnesses, common maladies that doctors treat, things like high blood pressure, diabetes. It's a combination of genetics and environment. And in some individuals, the genetics and the biology are really the major factors. And then in other people, the psychological factors, the environment, have a much more important role. And what psychiatrists essentially do when we make these diagnoses is try and separate out kind of which part of that to pay the most attention to. But again, to bring up something I was talking about before, this is the reason why most people with serious depression do the very best, have the best outcomes if they get both medical treatment and psychological treatment. There's tons of data going back decades that show that. And you're often on very thin ice if you see a person, and this goes for adults too, with a very serious depression, and you don't pay attention to both. And patients will often want to see their problem as either one or the other. And they'll want that pill that's going to make them feel better, and they're not interested in psychotherapy, or they are adamant against taking medication and only want to do psychotherapy, and both of those approaches are definitely second best and sometimes very unsuccessful.
Yeah, one without the other is often not quite enough.
Exactly. The kind of thing I tell people is, you know, a person with serious diabetes, they would not go to their doctor and say, yes, I'll take my insulin, but I'm not willing to lose weight. I'm not willing to change my diet. That's just not going to work. And it's the same kind of approach in psychiatric problems.
All right, so with adults, you got generally motivated people who want to be there. They've had enough of sort of this depressed mood. They, you know, their frontal lobe is online. In adolescence, we often have
sometimes.
but in adolescence, we generally have a, well, not all the time, but a majority of the time we have kids who are pretty resistant to therapy, pretty resistant to treatment. They don't think they have a problem. They're often smoking, you know, I got kids that are smoking weed every day, at 15, 16 years old. And that, really does, I mean, this gets really, really complicated when you're talking about attention deficit disorder with some depression and some, chronic marijuana abuse and a dysfunctional, like, relationship at home and with their parents. How do you ferret all that out as a family, and where do you start kind of picking that apart?
Well, boy, you really described the perfect storm there.
I see it. I see it all the time.
That's a situation that, yeah, that's going to take a lot of work to sort that all out. Generally, I think the place to start is, you know, having a discussion with the pediatrician or the family doctor. They have had training in recognizing mental health problems, and they usually have resources that they're very comfortable with and think highly of to make a referral. So, you know, dealing with a patient who is skeptical about the benefits of treatment, you know, that's something that we do as doctors and therapists. Sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's not so hard, but that's something that we usually can work with. And the thing to remember is that these kids, they're very unhappy.
Yes.
You know, their unhappiness may not be the most prominent thing that maybe an outsider would notice. The outsider might notice the, you know, the irritability and so forth. But it usually isn't too terribly difficult to engage the patient around what they think is wrong and what they think needs to get better. And if you meet people halfway, generally they'll become a lot more open-minded and accepting. I think more than any other specialty in mental health, you can't be a authoritarian figure, you know, I'm the doctor, do this.
Right.
That doesn't work. And it's much, much more important to have the patient see you as a you know, someone who's collaborating in their care, because they have to be the captain of their ship as far as psychiatric care. You know, we don't have any procedures where we you know, hold down a patient and do something that makes them better. You know, we don't take the screaming accident victim and give them anesthesia and, you know, do the surgery that they need done. There's nothing like that. In psychiatry, pretty much the patient is administering the treatment, and they have to decide that they're going to be a partner.
So with adolescents, it's very, very important that when parents are looking for a therapist, that they find a therapist who has good rapport with teenagers. A teen who likes his therapist is much more likely to show up. Who doesn't think of it as a horrible experience. I mean, you can lose them in the very first session has been my experience.
Sure.
Or you can turn them and win them over based on how you interact. So how should parents go about finding a therapist in, say, a local area?
Well, again, I would say the first person to consult is the pediatrician, the family doctor, because they generally know what the resources are. And the local mental health association will often have resources to share. The schools may have resources to share. But when there's evidence of a serious problem, some of the scenarios that you've painted, I think the first person that the parent talks to should be a doctor. You know, I think the psychiatrists are, we're in a better position to make a diagnosis, to, you know, pull the team together that's going to give the patient what he or she needs. You know, one of the scenarios you painted was someone using marijuana, using a lot of cannabis. And that right there is going to make any kind of diagnosis really difficult.
Yeah.
And so in a case like that, you know, there needs to be a doctor, there needs to be a therapist, and maybe there needs to be some kind of an addiction program as well to get everything taken care of. These can be very, very complicated disorders where teamwork is really important. Not all the time. I mean, I see college students generally. They're the adolescents that I usually see. They're 18, you know, early 20s, and they are often very motivated.
Yes.
For treatment, and you know, treating them is more like treating most of the other patients I see who are adults, but not always. And I think that's another interesting question. You know, someone who's 20 living away at college, are they more like an adolescent or more like an adult? And again, I think it depends. Sometimes when they're independent, when they're not quite so financially dependent on their parents, perhaps, but so they're basically leading more of an independent life and they want to make their own healthcare decisions, you know, somebody like me, who's mainly an adult psychiatrist, is going to be fine. You have the 14-year-old with all the complications that you've laid out. I might ask Dr. Kelly to see that patient because he's the one with the training as the child psychiatrist. So it's very complicated because these issues can overlap in very, very complex ways. And you need, you definitely need a captain of the ship. And I think when there's serious depression and medication involved, that needs to be a mental health doctor, a psychiatric specialist.
Okay, you brought up a question that I had that was sort of in the back of my mind, and I'll go ahead and ask it now. But there's substance abuse on board. Substance abuse in adolescence is a difficult thing to tackle, and I have parents all the time asking me, you know, well, is it okay if he smokes marijuana occasionally? If it's, you know, or should I have a zero tolerance policy? Should I send him to treatment? That's a scary and big thing to pull off, is to send your kid to some sort of substance abuse treatment center. When does that cross the line from experimentation into a problem?
Yeah, well, the criteria for what is an addiction are pretty straightforward, and it's when the individual loses control. So someone who is using marijuana or drinking frequently, and it's causing their grades to change, causing their social relationships to suffer, there are important negative consequences. And when the individual continues to use despite those negative consequences, they're by definition out of control. You know, there's very conflicting data on what the consequences of substance use in younger people, what those long-term consequences are. There is some data suggesting that early onset use of substances puts people at very high risk for lifelong addiction.
Right.
So that young people who use alcohol are extremely high risk for having alcohol problems later in life. There's some evidence that heavy use of cannabis or in the early teenage years puts people at risk for serious mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, even. There's not a lot of data. The data is conflicting. What I tell people who suffer from mood disorders is that we have pretty good data that if you have a mood disorders, your ability to use substances safely is not going to be the same as your buddies. And I will tell young people that. I'll say, you know, your buddies might be able to get away with smoking on the weekends, but the likelihood is that you are not going to be able to do that. Again, it's like having the conversation with the teenager who has diabetes. They can't have the same diet that their friends have. They have to have something that's tailored to their vulnerabilities, and I think that goes for substances too.
All right, so sort of bottom line is, what I tell parents is it's not a good idea for their kids to abuse anything chronically, for anybody really to abuse anything chronically, but the developing brain puts you at risk for future substance abuse and mental health problems and early onset. And if you combine that with a genetic sort of family history of substance abuse, you got it sort of a recipe for a bad scenario.
Right. Right. The other thing to remember with addiction is that we have lots of great epidemiological data showing that there is this huge overlap between people with mood disorders and people with addiction. And if you go beyond mood disorders and talk about a psychiatric diagnosis, we know that about 50% of people with a psychiatric diagnosis also have an addiction problem. And about 50% of people with an addiction have some kind of psychiatric problem. So there is a very, very frequently an overlap. And to say, to kind of get into arguments about which came first or which is causing what,
yeah,
it's just not useful. I tell people these are two different problems, and they're two very different kinds of problems. And you can't treat one and expect the other one to just go away. You need treatment for both.
Okay, we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. We'll remind listeners that this is Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is mood disorder expert Dr. Francis Mondemore from Johns Hopkins Medical Center. Our topic today is adolescent depression. You can reach us at 550-8433 or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Mondemore. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is mood disorder expert Dr. Francis Mondemore from Johns Hopkins Medical Center. Our topic today is adolescent depression. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally with your questions at 550-8433. Or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8 p.m., so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a tape recording, and we won't be able to accept your phone calls. Please feel free to call in and do it before the last 5 minutes of the show so that we can get you on the air and get your question answered with Dr. Mondemore. All right. So I want to get to something. I want to make sure that we don't miss the opportunity because we got a lot of content here. Dr. Mondemore, one of the things that parents come in all the time, and I'll tell you in my experience, most parents want their kid to go to a therapist before they go to a psychiatrist because they're terrified of putting their children on medications. And so what is what's the rationale for doing medications right away versus starting with a therapist and then just kind of get an idea of if that gets better, then you go from there?
Well, I think what's important is to make a proper diagnosis. And I see patients all the time that I say, you know, I think you should be in therapy for a while before making any decisions about medication, because it's not clear to me that medication is something that's going to be terribly helpful for you. So I think the important thing is to see a expert in both psychological medicine and psychiatry, essentially, both psychotherapy, psychological issues, and the medical issues, the genetically rooted mood disorders, to be able to say, okay, this is where things should start. Because frequently I'll also see patients, and it's just abundantly clear that what's going on in the patient's life just doesn't explain how awful they feel, and they've got all of the hallmarks of something biological. They have a family history. Other people in the family have been through the same thing. They've got all of those other symptoms, the concentration problems, energy level problems, sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, and it's just clear that sending the person off to do therapy for a month is not going to be terribly helpful and is going to prolong their discomfort. The other thing to realize is that the medications that we use to treat, especially adolescents, are very safe, very benign medications. Generally, the first line of treatment are the group of antidepressants called the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and medications like Paxil, Zoloft, Prozac, almost household names these days, I guess. They are especially effective in younger people most of the time. And, you know, at this point, they've been around since the late 1980s. So we've had many decades of experience with these medications, and there have been many patients who have been on them for decades. So we have a lot of experience with using them and using them safely.
All right. So there's a fairly good body of of evidence that they're safe with teenagers based on some of these older ones. All right. We got a caller here. Michael, you're on the air with Dr. Mondemore. Michael, you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
As a former community therapist that worked with two nonprofit children's agencies, I found that I pretty much agree with everything you say, but if there were problems with mom and dad within the nuclear family, found that sometimes the best laid plans of mice and men went astray when there are problems within the family itself. Could you comment on that?
Yes, we can comment on that. That was, in fact, you kind of beat me to the punch, because my next question was, sometimes we're treating the child, the parents are bringing them in for this sort of disruptive behavior, but the problem is really at home, and you hate to medicate, and we're certainly not going to blame all the parents for their kids' struggles, because that would be inaccurate and unfair, but there are cases in which the environment is such that the kid's got all sorts of stuff, anxiety, depression, he's watching violence going on, and that's not often talked about, but how do you ferret all that out, Dr. Mondemore?
Right. Well, sometimes it takes time. And, you know, you've just given an example of a situation in which maybe the biology isn't so important and the environment is the main factor. And, that, you know, I don't have to tell you, as someone who works with families, families often have secrets, and it can take time to be able to sort them out. But, you know, in psychiatry, we can't give a blood test or take a X-ray or do something like that to make a diagnosis. And then the other thing is that the problems that we try and treat are often triggered or sustained or made worse by many, many different kinds of factors. We were talking about addiction a moment ago. All right. And addiction needs a different kind of treatment. You can't give a pill for addiction.
Right.
And just talking about why someone drinks, you probably know, generally doesn't tell them what they need to do to stop drinking. And when there are behavioral, when there are family issues, well, then that's a whole nother approach that's required. And it's required to sort out what those problems are and to begin to help the family to communicate. I mean, this is the work that you do. You do it a lot more than I do it. But it's apparent, and that's why we have a collaborative system here at Johns Hopkins. Because sometimes you get into the treatment and it becomes clear that the medication is not really helping, and maybe these other factors begin to come out. And at that point, you pivot and you change the approach of treatment. But these are always, I shouldn't say always, these are very frequently complicated problems. You're dealing with biology, you're dealing with the effects of substances, you're dealing with family dynamics. All kinds of other factors can arise and be really important in understanding how to help. And it takes an expert and sometimes a team and time to sort that all out. Complicated mood disorders, you know, with all of these, especially when there are these other complications like addiction, they can take time to sort out. You know, we haven't even talked about other problems that you can not infrequently come across, things like eating disorders and cutting behaviors. And that adds another level of complexity. But there, you know, fortunately, we have a lot of great data about what kind of treatments help with these various problems. But it can sometimes take a while to find out what all the factors are and to begin to address them one by one. Freud talked about peeling an onion in doing psychoanalysis and getting all of the layers. And it takes time to do that.
Yeah, it is complex. And I think you point out a good thing. I have some parents come in and, you know, after the third session, they've met with me and they're like, you know, we're not seeing a whole lot of changes in Johnny. And I was wondering what you're doing. And, you know, it's like this didn't happen, you know, overnight, and it's not going to get better in a couple of weeks, a couple of sessions. This is often a long term process that requires the entire system, the family system, to be involved in the solution and not just the kid. And that's
right.
I often have
right.
a challenge.
Yeah, but, you know, we don't want to paint too bleak a picture, because sometimes, you know, the young person walks in and they realize they're not themselves, they're interested in treatment. Maybe they're one of the folks in which genes are a really big part of things. You prescribe a medication, you educate them about their problem, you work with them on learning how to cope better, manage stress better, and they can just blossom in a few weeks. I mean, I've certainly seen that happen. So we don't want to, you know, we don't want to be all doom and gloom here.
No, you're correct. I've had equal number of really positive experiences where you get maybe a pretty like angry kid, and I've misread him. I've thought, oh, this is going to be tough, and then they start talking and they just won't stop, and it all comes out, and they really want to get better, and it's quite rewarding. So
yeah,
that can happen as well. Let's go to another phone call. We have Jane on the air. You're on the air with Dr. Mondemore.
All right, thank you so much. First of all, I just want to say thanks for addressing all of this, what I think is actually a pretty more common problem than people really realize always, but you can feel kind of alone when you're in this situation, I guess I want to say. So thanks so much. But two things real quick. First of all, I just wanted to know, can you test for hormones like serotonin, dopamine, testosterone, or like GI gut flora? You know, how does all of this, you know, kind of maybe play into depression and things like that? And then secondly, I know you mentioned the SSRIs, and they do great things for some people, but if there's a family history of bipolar, for example, it can launch somebody into the mania phase. And you know, I don't know what that is. Could they possibly, if they didn't have that SRI, would they not get bipolar? You know, I mean, obviously they have a predisposition to it if they do by giving them an SSRI, but really to pick that apart and what might maybe be your treatment options.
Right. Well, you just introduced another whole area of complication, which is bipolar disorder. And we used to think that there were these two kinds of depression. There was sort of pure depression or unipolar depression, where a person only had depression symptoms. And then there was this other problem called manic depressive illness, where they had serious depression problems, but then they have other kinds of mood episodes where they become extremely elated or extremely irritable sometimes. And we used to think that they were two separate problems. And now we recognize, in fact, that they're better understood as existing on a continuum. And that, in fact, there are some people who can be just a little bit of bipolar, that the genetics is much more complex than anyone suspected. And there's a lot of overlap between these problems. So, again, that's a conundrum. That's a diagnostic dilemma. When a young person comes in, their first episode of serious depression, how do you know that this is not the depression of bipolar disorder? And there are a few hints. Family history is often a very good indicator. If there's a family history of bipolar disorder, the person presenting with depression is at much higher risk for, in fact, having bipolar disorder. And the treatments for bipolar disorder and pure unipolar depression are very different. There's a little bit of overlap, but with pure unipolar depression, generally the antidepressants are the first line of treatment. When the person, when there's a lot of worry about bipolar disorder, there's just a whole other set of medication options that are available. And again, as I was saying earlier, it used to be that if a person was depressed, they got antidepressants. If they had bipolar disorder, they got lithium. And now we know that, in fact, now we have a lot more medications available than those two. And it turns out that a lot of people do the very best on a combination of treatments for both problems, for bipolar disorder, and maybe they take an antidepressant too. But it just points out that these are not easy diagnoses to make, and it can take months to get it all sorted out. When we see patients in our clinic here who present and they're having a lot of symptoms, a lot of instability, maybe they've tried a whole bunch of different medicines in the past, I'll frequently tell them that it may take 6 months to sort this all out and for you to feel really well. And we're going to have to work hard at sorting this out. These are very difficult to diagnose problems. And when there are these other complications, that can prolong the process. So that was the antidepressant bipolar question. I'm sorry, I forgot what your first question
was. Yeah, the first one was, it was just as far as, like, maybe testing for, I know you touched on genetic components.
Oh, okay,
for,
okay, right.
You know, specific
yeah.
serotonin.
We don't really have any tests for these problems. You mentioned testing serotonin and so forth. These are, I mean, this is, on an ultra-microscopic level, tiny, tiny changes in levels deep within the brain and in basically inaccessible areas of the brain. There is something called the blood-brain barrier, so that, in fact, the chemistry of the brain has sort of sits behind this insulation that often is not reflected when you, for example, do a blood test. So what's going on in the brain chemically may be very different from what's going on in the rest of the body. There's a little bit of hope and some very interesting developments about doing imaging studies in people with depression. We do know that, in fact, when you look at large numbers of people with depression and compare very specialized brain scans with scans done of healthy controls, there are differences that you can pick up, but unfortunately, the range of normal variation is so wide that we are not able to do a scan on an individual person and make a diagnosis. So, as far as testing for the chemistry that we know is involved in mood disorders, we're simply not there yet. There's a little, or in fact, the genetics of mood disorders is sort of moving in a slightly different direction. People have been trying for 30 or 40 years to find genes that were associated with these disorders, and the search has been quite disappointing. A newer approach is, rather than looking for risk genes for a disease, rather than looking for genes that predict an illness or diagnose an illness, looking for genes that predict that a particular medication is going to be helpful. We've, in fact, just finished up a very large project, an international project, looking at the genetics of lithium response in patients with serious bipolar disorder. And there were some findings. There were some genetic signals that indicate some of the chemistry involved in getting better with lithium from bipolar disorder, and basically lithium working in bipolar disorder. And that's going to be very helpful going forward. If it does pan out, we'll be able to do tests and know what medication is going to work the best. We're already doing a little bit of that. We have a test for a particular gene that all of the SSRI medications work through, and we know if a person has a particular genetic pattern that SSRI medications are not going to be effective for this individual. And we're just taking baby steps along that line, but I think in the next 10 years that's going to be very, very dramatically different. And in fact, the treatment of all psychiatric problems is, I think, going to become increasingly medicalized, and we will be doing a lot of testing. We know that things like diet are very important in mood disorders in some individuals. I read an article a few weeks ago out of Japan that looked at the bacteria living in the gut of individuals with depression as opposed to people who did not have depression, and found some very interesting differences, and the kind of differences that variations in dairy intake affects. So we're beginning to make all of these connections. We've understood for a long time that there was a connection between thyroid disorders and depression. So I pretty routinely check thyroid hormones on individuals who are not responding in the usual way to an antidepressant medication. So the bottom line is that these are complicated problems in which there's lots of biological factors, lots of psychological factors, and it can be very challenging to sort it all out and find out which are the factors that are most salient for this particular individual. We're moving towards the age of very individualized care, and these genetic tests, I think, are part of that.
That's the holy grail, right? It's trying to figure out how to be able to read these things. All right. Thanks for your call, Jane. I appreciate it. I hope it sounds like that probably got it answered. We have time for a quick call. Jan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. And this is very, very complicated, I know. My 7-year-old granddaughter on one particular day became suicidal. And she was trying to cut herself. And she went into terribly psychotic behaviors. She ultimately was put on psychotropic medications and stuff. But because my daughter knew for sure that it was something specific that caused this behavior, she has relentlessly just tried to find out what the problem was. And we are 6 years later and just discovered that what she has is PANS. And it was brought on from a tick. She got Lyme disease, and as a result of that, she has PANS. And she just came through the Cunningham panel of tests, and they were able to prove that what she has was an autoimmune antibodies, you know, that are causing these problems. But every single time she would get sick, she would go into a psychotic, thing, and it was just absolutely horrible. And for 6 years, the family has just suffered through, and because it was an autoimmune thing, she was sick often. And she had all of the symptoms that you talk about with gut disorders.
All right, Jan, I hate to cut you off, but we're running out of time here. I think that I really do appreciate the call. I wish we had more time to go into that. Can you leave your phone number with Dave off the air, and I'll get back with you. Dr. Mondemore, just got about, 30 seconds left. Tell us what you want people to think about or remember from your time here.
Well, I think the number one thing is to recognize that depression is a common problem. It's a serious problem, but it's a very, very treatable problem. And that when a teenager is showing the signs of depression, the symptoms of depression, it's time to do something about it and to get them into treatment.
All right. My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Francis Mondemore. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Dr. Mondemore.
My pleasure.
All right. Please remember to check out the variety of links to today's show. You can go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. No show next week, but be sure to join Dr. Woodard and his guests in 2 weeks as they explore the role of toxic chemicals on neurodevelopment, children's cancer, and birth defects. That's Monday, September 12th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line 1. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.